Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome to the program Lori Potas. She is the director of the Raptor Center in El Dorado, where I am sitting right now. What is the Raptor Center all about?
It's about taking birds that are native species or species that migrate through, both raptors and songbirds, and rehabilitating them. They've been hit by a car, they've been shot, they're orphaned, injured somehow, and unfortunately a fair amount of the injuries are human-caused. So we get them, we try to fix them back up, get them going, and send them back out to the wild.
So let's talk for a moment about what raptors are. Raptor is a term that encompasses a lot of different species.
Yes, a raptor is not a dinosaur, but I do believe when you look at their feet, you think they must have come from the dinosaurs. It's a bird of prey, a bird that catches its food live. They have to have talons, very strong feet, very good eyes, and a strong beak. That's kind of essentially what makes a raptor.
So that's hawks,
eagles, owls, falcons.
Oh, okay. Now, many birds are birds of prey. I mean, seagulls are birds of prey.
That is true.
But this is a
seagulls don't
subcategory.
Have feet. Right. They have to have certain, their feet can grab.
And so that's how they, like, you see them killing their prey. What does that look like?
What does that look like? That's a good question. It's pretty fast. They choke it to death with their feet, usually. You know, it's not tortured.
Right.
Yeah.
What do they eat?
Depending on your raptor, a lot of them, like if you want to be general, rabbits, mice, snakes, lizards, rats. Like barn owls are pretty much rat and mice eaters. Eagles will eat snakes. They like, golden eagles like rabbits. They have a taste for rabbit. Red-tailed hawks will probably eat snakes also, and lizards, but they're also rodent eaters. Now, Swainson's hawks and kestrels. Kestrels are a falcon, the smallest falcon in North America. They will also take bugs. And Swainson's hawks eat grasshoppers. They love grasshoppers, which you never think you complain about not having grasshoppers, but we don't have enough this year for them.
So part of what's going on now, and we'll get to this more in a moment, mm-hmm. but you are basically holding some of these raptors, which are ready for release because there's not enough food out in nature for them to eat. Is that right?
Yes, and this is the first time in 11 years. I've done this for 11 years. I've seen anything like this. The weather, between the fires, the wind, and the extreme dry, we have been asked by certain people in Game and Fish and by Dr. Ramsey to hold on to them because their chances would just not be good. So we are looking for places. There's a couple places we're scouting out to get rid of, to release some of our eagles and some of our red tails and a Swainson's hawk that I have that are ready to go.
How did you start doing this?
How did I start doing this? I lived in the Philippines many years ago. I went back in 99 and took a trip with a group of people and stood out on a beach. This is really how this happened in Boracay. If you've ever been to Boracay, it's a beautiful place. And every morning and said, I don't like my life and I'm going to do what I really want. That's how I did this.
And what you really wanted to was to rescue birds of prey?
Well, it was to work with animals. You know, I've always, as a child, I spent a lot of time alone. I felt like such an odd duck, so to speak. And I think when you're an odd duck, you end up hanging around in different pockets of, different pockets of reality, and it's not always with people. So I was a kid that we had horses and we lived out, and I spent a lot of time alone. And so here I am.
So alone means not with people, but maybe with other animals.
Right, with animals, with the dogs, with the horse, with the donkey. Yeah, hiking, yeah.
And so how did you come to this specific place, El Dorado, and raptor rescue in particular?
I worked for the Wildlife Center years ago, and I worked, Dr. Ramsey I'm very grateful and lucky. She was my teacher because she's the best.
Now, she's tell us about her for a moment.
Okay, Dr. Kathleen Ramsey is a vet. She's also an amazing vet. I've seen her do some amazing surgeries. She is also a wildlife vet and probably the best in the Southwest, not just the state, but the Southwest. And she ran the Wildlife Center for years. She's no longer with them. That's relatively new. I think she does some stuff for them, but she's not with them. And I worked with her for many years, and then I branched off and I also worked with other animals, mammals also. And now I don't have the room or the caging or probably the energy to take on other animals at this point.
And so you
Which
take
makes
on
my
these...
board very happy. They're like, no bears, please.
So tell us more about the ways that you find animals. Like, give us some examples.
People find them, and they call me. And I've had people call me from Roswell. I have no idea how they got the Santa Fe Raptor Center phone number, but I'm glad they have it. I have vets that call me from down south. I have another woman who does what I do, but not in the same capacity or with the same room. And so they come through vets, through just people driving along the side of the road, and they found an owl that had been hit by a car, through veterinarians.
And what are some of the problems or injuries that these birds have when they end up here?
Hit by a car, gunshot wound. They can have head trauma for being grazing a car. You know, a couple of them have a thing called trich, which is a disease that they get from eating a pigeon that has it. I have an owl that was caught in fishing line. Somehow he was a baby. He fledged and got stuck down in fishing line, and they got him out, but his foot was damaged. Caught in traps. I mean, really, not good stuff.
And so, for example, when these owls or other raptors are shot, what's going on? Are people trying to, are they hunting? Are they, what are they doing?
It's illegal to hunt. I don't know. I mean, I have never, luckily for their sake, I have never met somebody who shot or admitted to shooting a bird. I mean, the bird flies away. You know, I mean, it gets hit and it goes down. They don't get the feathers. They don't get the bird. I'm not sure. I don't understand that mindset at all.
And when an animal, you're not a veterinarian, so no. When an animal like that comes to you, what's the first thing you do, like an animal that's been shot?
I need to get an x-ray. So I get that. And I also go, I get my x-rays and I do a fair amount. Dr. Brent Parker at the Santa Fe Animal Hospital is also helping me. He's a great vet. He's also, he's a very good guy. And I can call him up and say, I need to bring three birds instead of one. And he always accommodates me, and I appreciate that. So I take them there, I get an x-ray, and we do an assessment. And then if they need to do surgery, Dr. Ramsey has done surgery on bird wings forever. So I take them up there.
If an animal has a broken wing, can it be healed enough so that it can fly and go back out into the wild?
They're amazing. It can be healed by our help. And it can be, I've had birds that have come to me so late. What happens is it's already healed. It's a big, like the red tail I showed you earlier. She's got a big knot. Both the ulna and radius bone in her wing are one bone right now in one spot. It's knitted together. And she can fly. But the problem was is she used her muscle, her flying muscle, to live off of. Because once they're down, if they're they can be down for 2 weeks and they live off of their own muscle. They don't have fat like we do. Or they could live a lot longer. So they live off that muscle and then they can't fly. They have no muscle to fly with. So sometimes they're already healed. In their own strange way, it's healed and it's actually doable, but they have no muscle to fly with, so they're grounded and someone finds them.
And so then you find them, feed them, and when they're strong enough, you can let them go.
Right, and then you have to, I also do a thing called kill training where they have to catch live rats. Even if it's an adult that knows how to kill, I need to make sure that everything is functioning. And so that is just a prerequisite that they all get that.
Tell us what the accommodations are like for your birds.
The accommodations are, the standards are set up by U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and I actually have a book that tells you what you can and can't do. And when I took you back there, if you noticed, the slats in my cages are all straight up and down, like a tree. They're looking through something that is more like a tree, not, you don't want to go the other way, horizontal. And the eagles have to have, my cage is 10 feet wide, and it's the L shape. They were once in that, right now they're in half of it, but that's 100 feet long. And I can open that, you know, the one side of the owls and one side of the eagles. That can be opened. And they were in that because they had to stretch their wings. And they require a larger cage. So that is 10 feet wide, 12 feet high, and 100 feet long.
And so they can actually, and as I saw before when you were showing me, they can actually fly. So when you have even babies, they learn to fly in these big cages.
And so you need to build up, if it's a baby, it doesn't have much muscle, so it has to build it up. If it's an adult and it's come in injured, it probably doesn't have much muscle, it's lost it. So you're building, it's a building up process of the muscle, the flying muscle.
We're talking to Lori Potas of the Raptor Center here in El Dorado. So some of your birds actually have foster parents. How does that work? What's going on?
My owls are wonderful foster parents, and kestrels make good foster parents. They will take their own species, not another species, but they'll take their own species, and you just, you know, put it in there, and they take it. And I have that female, the one that was hissing and hooting at us. Yeah, she is actually very protective. And luckily, we were far enough away that she doesn't fly well enough, that's why she's with us, to get loose. But if she could, she would have hit us in the head. we would have been hurt. She's very protective of her babies. And what she does is you bring a small baby to these owls. I get these fuzzy guys, and she sits with them and they hide behind her, and they understand by her behavior and by being with her all day and only seeing me a couple of times a day that that's what they are. They're an owl. They're not a person. So they don't imprint on me. They imprint on her.
Now, I imagine that there have been cases where owls or any kind of bird has imprinted on a human.
I've gotten birds that have been someone imprinted and then gave to me. My Harris hawk is not releasable. She's fully flighted, meaning she can fly, but she's not releasable because kids got her out of a nest and she was raised by people.
And so she thinks she's a person?
She would probably, what she would do, she can hunt. I mean, she likes to kill things. But she would probably end up on somebody's porch. You know, and they would, of course, she'd be screaming at them because she's noisy. And they would think she, you know, what are you going to think?
Right.
It's a killer bird. It's a killer bird. So it does not do them any favors for people to raise birds. And if you put them on the wrong perch, their feet end up messed up. If they don't eat the right things, it will actually kill them later. Or they can get what they call metabolic bone disease, and you can't turn that around. So they don't have enough calcium. So it's not a good idea for a person to find a baby raptor and raise it.
So when somebody does find a raptor, an owl, a hawk, whatever, and they want to mm-hmm. bring it to you, I mean, it's sitting there maybe flapping, maybe screaming on the ground, or what should they do?
If you have leather gloves, put them on. You know, people tell me they found this raptor and they caught it. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not going to ask how what happened, because their feet will grab you out of fear and out of, you know, trying to hold on. And you can get a towel or a blanket or a big shirt and just throw it over the top of them and just scoop them up and put them in a box.
And then call you.
Yes. Yeah.
And we'll give the number. Okay, give the number now. We'll give it again at the end of the show.
505-699-0455.
So these owls and these raptors, they don't imprint on you. That means they're releasable. They're still wild animals. You're rehabilitating them. Do they recognize you?
They recognize me because they see me daily. But the nice thing about being out here, and once in a while I have somebody help me, I have a volunteer help me, but they mostly see me. So they're not used to people. And the noises out here, you know, they're hearing the wind, the other birds. They're isolated enough that they're pretty wild. When I catch them, it's definitely a fight. They don't want to be caught.
Do they eventually begin to understand that you're helping them?
I think they do, but that doesn't mean that they're friendly, and you certainly don't want them friendly. You know, when we were in the barn owl cage, and I was saying that they were, you know, they're hissing and clacking at us. That's a good sign.
Yeah.
They have no intention of, you know, being friendly with a human being. So when they're released, they're not going to land on somebody's porch and beg for food.
Right.
They're going to be gone, and that's what you want.
And it's very important to realize that they're not pets, and that they'll never be pets, and they shouldn't be pets.
No, and they're not. They wouldn't be happy. You know, people say, isn't it hard to release them? It's really very exciting to release them. It makes me will be very excited to get those eagles out, and that's where they belong. You know, and the larger female that had the white on her, the younger one. I mean, she has 2 more years before she's really. It's 4 years before they're a breeding adult, and so you know, she's this big healthy bird that will genetically add to the eagles in New Mexico.
How do you, explain to us what they need developmentally. So you get these little fuzz balls that are owls, and you have to raise them until they're ready to be released. What happens at each stage? What do they need? What do you do? I mean, the very smallest one, sometimes you have to have them in your house.
Yes, I had a great horn last year that fit in the palm of my hand. It was the smallest great horn. He was so cute. Anyways, It's tricky because they have to gain 15 to 20 grams a day. So they have to gain a huge amount of weight. They are hatched out early spring, and they have to be able to go by fall. I mean, they grow up, it's a very quick process. So they have to be completely ready to go. Can you imagine if it was that way with human beings? Bye. 4 months later. Good luck. But so they come in very small. They have to stay warm enough. You want them perched or sitting up the right way, because if they're laying wrong, they'll get liquid in their chest. And actually, a baby raptor that falls out of a nest, if something happens and he's laying down, can get hypothermia and pneumonia in a half an hour.
Good heavens.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, so when I get them, I'm thinking about, I need to get them fed, get them hydrated and fed well enough. I need to make sure they get enough calcium. I need to make sure they're warm enough. I need to make sure I don't imprint them. I mean, it's like a little dance you're doing to try to make it all work so that they eat enough, they have enough calcium, they're warm enough, they're perched right, but they're also not used to me.
And how do you do that if you're so close to them?
When I had the little baby guy last year, I took him out And I had him in a little carrier, and I put him with the mom. So he was there. And then I went out to feed him. And then in the night, when there were a couple of nights it was cold because I got him in March, I brought him in. When he got bigger, he went out there and stayed with her the whole time when he was eating on his own, and I wasn't hand-feeding him. And you start out by feeding them little bitty bits of stuff, you know, bits of mice, bits of cut-up skinned mouse. Doesn't that sound good? You're sorry you didn't come for breakfast. And then it gets bigger and it gets bigger and it's, you know, but you want, they have to have that bone. They have to have that, and you want to make sure they're digesting. I mean, there's a whole lot going on there because you don't know how long they were down or what their conditions are. But you definitely don't want to imprint them in that process.
You've become kind of a surrogate veterinarian.
That's a compliment. I don't think so. If you, I've worked for vets and they do a whole lot more than I do and know a whole lot more, but thank you.
But I mean, for these things, you have to know.
Right.
All of these.
You know that calcium is very important for baby raptors. You know, and you can't, I mean, you could give them powdered calcium if they're really sick and put it on a piece of chicken. But what you really want to do, the ideal thing, is to give them the bone, the gut, the fur, you know, the whole, that's what they would eat in the wild. So you want to imitate that as much as possible.
Now, some of the birds you have that are called educational birds are birds that are unreleasable. Tell us some of their stories.
My Harris hawk was stolen out of a nest. The great horned owl came...
Stolen out of a nest?
Stolen out of my kids.
Down
Rio Doso, yes. So she's what they call fully flighted. There's no injury. The injury is that she's unfortunately imprinted upon people.
Yeah.
The barn owl and the great horned owl had broken wings. It didn't heal where they can fly really well. So they're not, they don't fly well enough to hunt and make it on their own. Who else do we have? I have a Swainson's hawk that had a wing that didn't heal right. Gunshot wound. A red-tailed wing that didn't heal right. Gunshot wound, unfortunately.
Now, are these animals more imprinted on you or have more of a relationship with you than the others?
Well, some my educational birds are up with a woman named Laura Schwartz in Los Alamos. Most of them. I've got a couple here for foster parents, and I've got my Harris hawk stays with me. And she has worked with educational birds for more than 20 years. She's amazing. She's really talented as far as getting them to sit on a glove and go into a classroom. And they get used to you, and they get used to what you're doing. You know, I mean, part of it is what we've taken is educational, the equipment that goes on the bird, the anklets, the jesses, the leash, you know, the way you tally them on your glove is stolen from the falconer's world. And so that's a very, very old art that has been around forever. And so they do well with it. They're also outside in cages. They're not pets. We don't pet them and, you know, they don't come inside and, you know, act like the dog
like
would.
A dog, right?
Yeah. But they are, first of all, their personality has to be calm and sort of amenable to being in captivity. And you sense that. You know, I've had birds that are just, they can't go back out, but they're really jumpy and crazy. And it's unfair to them to keep them. You know,
now, I guess birds like dogs, like people, like any other species, there's a lot of personality variation.
Yes, in every one of them, that's what's amazing. That's, you know, you'd think that that's not true, but it is. Yes, they do have personality. I started baby Huey, the golden eagle eat anything.
So you've got some golden eagles here, and for example, baby Huey, tell us about what your hopes and intentions are for him.
Yes, but that's a nickname, by the way, that he got because he will eat anything, and he runs around and cries to all the adults, feed me, even though he's full. So he came a couple of weeks ago from some west of Truth or Consequences, and he was found by El Paso Electric. Now, I've spoken with a friend, Dale Stoliker, who's also a bander, eagle bander, and he works with, he goes out and monitors nests and does all this stuff. So he said there's a good chance the parents were teaching him to hunt and somebody, you know, someone with good intentions interfered. I don't know if that's the case or not. He was thin. He came in. He's an adult size, but he has that fuzzy white patch on his chest. He's this year's baby. You know, it's amazing. And you said he's big. Yeah, they get big fast.
Big.
He's big. He's baby Huey. And he was found out. He may have been abandoned, something may have happened to the parents, or they may have been teaching him to hunt. He's not flying yet. He was thin. He didn't have any muscle. But they start out, all birds, all raptors, have a teenage stage, and they try to fly before they're ready. And so the parents will feed them on the ground. if it's, you know, they'll go on the ground and holler. And same with songbirds. You know, people call me and say, there's a songbird on the ground, and it's, if you don't have pets around and nothing's bothering it and you see the parents, leave it there because they will feed it and get it going, you know, because they can fly down like a little umbrella. They put their wings out, but they don't have the muscle yet to get up. And you can actually, I've got off the subject, I'm sorry, but you can actually see the barn owls and the great horned owls and other birds, they'll sit in the cage and flap and flap, and they're building up that muscle.
Yeah.
And then pretty soon they flap and flap and they go up. It's like, wow, it works. This really works. But we're working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife to see if we can put him where Dale, the man who does the banding, knows where there's a nest and a baby about his size in that nest, a little smaller. And what you do is you don't put him in the nest. You put him somewhere below it. And the parents are hardwired. They hear him crying, and they don't think, gee, last night, honey, we only had one baby. Now we have two. They just say, he's crying. We feed him. And right. So that would be, they would finish his training to be released, to, you know, be able to hunt.
So basically foster parenting is a common or natural thing in the animal kingdom, at least the bird kingdom.
On some level, yes, that would be a good way to put it. Because, for instance, the little sace phoebes that are up there on my light, if I were to put a finch in there and it cried, she would feed it.
Yeah.
Because it's crying. You know, it's got its big mouth open.
Now, you also work with songbirds.
Some, yes. I have a songbird person, Joe Ferdinand, also up in Los Alamos. And she's done that for 20 years also. And she's very talented with that.
What tell us some of those stories.
Well, songbirds, unfortunately, a lot of songbirds, two things seem to happen to songbirds. They hit windows, and they get caught by cats. There's a fair amount of that. And sometimes this year...
House cats?
Yes, house cats. This year, a lot of the raptors and songbirds, the winds have been so strong that they've been blown, nests have been blown down, and things like that have happened. And so she takes them. She can take a baby songbird that has just hatched out of an egg and keep it alive.
Oh,
and that is
goodness.
No small feat.
Yeah.
Can't hold its head up, and she has to put a Q-tip under its chin. I mean, it's amazing. I've watched her.
Now, why... I mean, are songbirds endangered? Why save them?
Oh. Did you like my reaction? They're not endangered. There are some that are endangered, of course. There are birds out there, you know, of all species that are endangered. But I guess cats kill so many songbirds a year. It's a huge amount. And people find them and don't want to, you know, you find this poor little thing and you want it to make it.
Yeah. Well, it's...
And they're native and they're protected. They're protected by Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Both U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Game and Fish, we have permits with those organizations to do what we do.
We talked on this program once about a book called Rewilding the World. And it was very interesting because the book starts with a story about the development of a canyon in California that reduced the number of, I think it was coyotes. The coyotes were keeping the cats in check. And so when the coyotes were killed, the number of songbirds went down.
Wow.
Because there were more cats, and they were eating the songbirds. So all of these relationships of keeping basically predation and keeping species in check are complicated.
Yes, and I think you made a very good point, because I think as human beings, we are so quick to manipulate things and not to realize what we're doing. You know, I grew up in Arizona, and there's a place called Deep Well Ranch where I rode a horse, and the rancher was very angry with the coyotes, and he trapped a lot that year, and then he had rabbits eating everything.
Yeah.
It didn't do him any favors.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. You know, we somehow want to jump in and control and move and manipulate, and it's not wise. But we haven't figured that out yet.
We have not figured that out yet. We're talking to Lori Potas, director of the Raptor Center in El Dorado. So tell us about the current weather and climate conditions and the fires and the relationship to what you're doing.
I don't know what we're going to see from the fires. The unfortunate thing about the fires is that it's the season where there's fledglings, so they're going to burn up. And, you know, I'm thinking about spotted owls, which are endangered, and the northern goshawk, which is up in the Los Alamos area, which is also, they're not endangered, but they're a species of concern. And so you've got all that. Who knows what's happening there? And then the wind, the way the wind has driven the fires. So I don't know. I haven't gotten anything from a fire. But what does happen during a fire is a lot of times species that did not live in a certain area will move because they have no other place to go. So we may see in the fall, we may see something interesting there as far as birds moving to areas that they normally wouldn't be from the fires, but the winds, the fires, and the dry has created a situation where we are not supposed to be releasing at this point in time.
So you have all these birds that are ready, you have some birds that are ready to be released,
correct.
And you've been asked not to release them.
Right. And what has happened is, and I agree with that, because you get the two golden eagles that you saw, the two females, they came in weighing under 6 pounds. That's starvation. That's really not. One had a wound on her wing. I don't know if she hit a car, and it didn't break. Maybe there was what they call a hairline fracture. I don't know, because it was healed. But it put her down long enough so that she could not get back in the air. And you work very hard. You feed them back up. Now they weigh, the big one weighs around 12 pounds, and the other one's about 10 or 11, which is more what they should be. 9 to probably 12. 12 is big. She's a big girl. She's just big. And you work really hard, and you want these birds to go out, and you want them to breed. I do, you know, because I feel like we never have enough wild animals. That's just, you know, there's just, being in this position, there's sort of this panic of how we're, I mean, the fires are taking up all this territory, and then there's housing projects all over the place, and, you know, there's always something, I feel like, there's always something against the wild population. There's just that pervading sense of, you know,
95% of wildlife habitat in the nation is gone.
Right. And so there's this, you know, you get into this place and it's in your heart where you just want everything to make it and you want it to have a second chance and you want it to breed. And so to release them after all that work and getting their weight up and they're killing and they're flying, and then know that I'm putting them out in a place where, because of horrible conditions, they would have to struggle, what's the point? I would rather hold them and feed them a couple of months longer.
Now that, of course, is an extra expense for you.
Yes.
And
for the Santa Fe Raptor Center is an extra expense, yes. And we've had more birds. We have 38 in rehab right now. And, I mean, the season is not over. I don't know what I could get to. I can get a phone call. The thing about this business that's interesting is you can go along and somebody will call you and say, all of a sudden, birds, you know, 5 birds are coming up from Carlsbad from a vet. And you take them. You know, you do what you can.
Yeah. So you are, among other things, looking for support from the public.
Yes, and this year, every year it's important, but this year, because we have so many and we cannot release, it's a big deal to be supported. And that, you know, the baby golden eagle is hungry, and he eats, oh my gosh, he eats probably what 3 birds would eat. I told you how he grabs the other the other food and holds it in his feet and walks around, you know, carrying. And the other eagles allow him. I hope they're up. They're still eating, but they're not getting as what they would get because they allow him because they know he's a baby.
Yeah. So people can, if they want to support this wonderful place, go to santaferaptorcenter.org, and there they'll find your number. And can call or they can just make a donation. Can they make a donation online?
They can't make a donation. Excuse me, online. The other thing they can do is I can give out our P.O. box, and people have sent us checks. Do you want me to do that now?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's the Santa Fe Raptor Center, P.O. Box 32021, Santa Fe, New Mexico, 87594. Now, if you give us a large donation, because somebody out there wants to, I can feel it. we are a 501c3, and it is a tax write-off, and I will send the letter that they need if they wish to do that.
What is the life like of a hawk, of an owl, of an eagle, when it is in the wild? Where are these birds nesting in the area that we live? What are their lives like when they're free?
In the area right now, in this area, there are barn owls, because I've had someone bring me one from a chimney, and there are great horned owls. And actually, the funny story, my female great horned owl, the big one that I told you was mean and protects her babies, she was calling before she got any babies in the early spring. She was calling a male, and she got him to come in. And you see him sitting out there at night. The minute she got a baby, she wouldn't talk to him. Gotta love those fickle women. She just wanted some kids.
That is so funny. And it didn't matter. They were foster kids. You brought them to her.
I set them down there, and she clacked at me like, how dare you take my baby? And I thought, I just brought it to you. I didn't take it away.
Right.
What is their life like in the wild? Their life is not easy. I mean, you know, unlike us, if we're hungry, we can stop somewhere. If we're broke, we can beg our friend to feed us. I mean, you know, we have, if they don't catch that day, they don't eat. That's, you know, that's how it is.
Do they nest in trees?
Some birds nest in trees. Sometimes they'll nest on a ledge. Burrowing owls nest with prairie dogs in burrows and on the ground. And they live symbiotically with prairie dogs. Interesting relationship.
So Lori, what is involved with keeping the raptor center open and solvent?
Oh, we have food bills, we have vet bills, and both vets donate a lot of time or give us discounts, and I appreciate that. The upkeep of the cages is expensive because the weather is so harsh. It's either, you know, this, you know how this winter was.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, you have wood cracking and all that stuff. It's either really cold or really wet or really dry or really windy. And so the upkeep of the cages, vet supplies. I have supplies. I do a lot of wrapping in my own wings and things, and I have to keep supplies, medications, and food. The food bill right now is astronomical. It's about $1,500 to $1,800 a month.
Oh, my goodness.
Which will go down in the winter. But I have, you know, the thing about that is when you have babies, and I have 9 baby Great Horns, 9 baby Barn Owls, and some of the Swainson's Hawks that came in are young. And then the Golden Eagle that makes up for everybody because he eats everything. They have to eat double what adults would eat because they're astronomically growing. You know, they're going through a 4-month period of just growing and growing and growing, and then they kind of taper off when they start flying.
Do you have to buy live animals?
Well, I buy both. I buy frozen, because you start with frozen, they can't fly, and you start cutting it up, and you're hand-feeding, then you're setting it on a log in front of them, and they're getting it. And that happens faster when they have the foster parent. There's not so much hand-feeding in my, you know, my end of the deal, because they have mom who shows them how you do this. And then today I told you I would be loading sand into that and fixing that cage up that the Great Horned Owls are in, because I will start kill training them once they're up like they are and they fly back and forth as well as they do. It's time to start. So I will buy live.
So kill training is you get live animals and then you just watch them learn to
you get
hunt
live,
and kill.
Yeah, I'll start with small rats and you let them loose in there and they chase them around and they get it.
Yeah.
It's instinctual. There's something in there, you know, that figures that out.
Right. Do the people who bring you these birds then follow their progress?
A lot of them do, and they're very, they're very dear. It's very important to them, and there's an experience. There's something that translates or comes through, or, you know what I mean, when you pick this animal up and you look in the eyes and maybe you see yourself, you know what I mean, because I think we're all, what I love about raptors is they're incredibly strong and they're incredibly delicate. And wrapped in one body, and I feel that's me,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
So people will call and they'll want to, you know, can I see it and what's going on with it? And I try to keep in touch with people. Sometimes I'm horrible at it, and you just have to hammer me with phone calls. But there was a woman last year, Lorraine Mills, who does a TV program, and she brought me her and some girls that she knew brought me a red tail. I'm gonna say it was January or February. It was winter time, and he was laying in the box with his face flat. That's not a good sign. And she said, "Here, can you save it?" And when I see that, I said, "It doesn't look good." And because I always want to be honest with people, you know. And I said, "I will do what I can. I don't know what's wrong, but it doesn't look good. We think he was hit by a car, and what had happened is the wing was already mending. But he was starved. He was very starved. He was starved enough that when you open a box as a rehabber and you look at the raptor, if it doesn't look back at you, it's in trouble. Because they instantly want to, get away from you. They're usually very alert. And they will do that clear up until the second before they die. So it has bad head trauma or it's starving if it does not respond. And so he didn't respond. And I thought, oh, no. But I did manage, had him inside. I hand-fed him and tubed him and got him back up and got him out. And she came out and saw him released. And it was something that was very important to her. And she'd called me a couple of times.
And so when you might be out in the wild yourself and you see a bird, it might be a bird that you know.
Yes, it might be a bird that I know. And there was actually an owl last year, a Great Horned Owl I released down in Glorieta area? Galisteo. I mix those two up all the time. And it came, I don't know why it came back, but I could tell by a sound it made. And it sat on the cage and was talking to the other ones for a while, and then it was gone. Never saw it again. So
it does make you, I mean, I've often thought that there is a capacity for interspecies understanding, almost like nonverbal, but somehow kind of semi-linguistic, that we've just lost because we only talk to each other. And when you observe that, on some level, you're really observing them talking to each other linguistically. They understand what each other is saying.
There is a great understanding there. There is, and there's an understanding. They're very clear to me. I feel like they're very straightforward and very clear to me. I feel like I do understand how far to push, how close I can get, and if I'm working with them and I'm trying to say something, you know, and they get it. I feel like it's clearer than human communication. It's more rewarding. So I would agree with you on that.
Lori Paras is director of the Raptor Center in El Dorado, which can be found at P.O. Box 32021 in Santa Fe. The zip code is 87594. And what's the phone number again?
505-699-0455.
Now, you are certainly looking for donations because, as you said before, it's been a rough and crazy year.
Yes, it's different than any year. I've done this for 11 years. I've never seen anything like this as far as weather and dryness and not enough food, you know, sources out there. So we are definitely looking for donations. And I do want to say that earlier this year we asked and we put stuff out there. And the people of Santa Fe and northern New Mexico and the surrounding areas are incredibly, incredibly generous. And I'm very grateful. And I want them to know that it's recognized. You know, it's recognized. I see that. And
the center is running very well and you're doing the work.
Yes. And I love the birds. And when you see one in the sky, if you've donated, please know it might have something to do with it. You know, it might be a bird that had something to do with your donation. Because with 9 great horned owls and 9 barn owls and 4 eagles, you're going to see somebody. And 5 Swainson's hawks. And I mean, yeah, I could go on and on. 5 kestrels. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And we've got a little time left, so we are talking today to Bill Hutchison from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Welcome back, Bill.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. How are you?
Good, good. Now, let's talk about the fire situation in New Mexico. We talked to the Española Valley Humane Society right during the worst of the fire, the multiple wildfires that were going on, but particularly in Los Alamos, the Las Conchas fire. How has the Santa Fe Animal Shelter been preparing for fire? I understand that you've been doing this for years, since that huge, what was it, Cerro Grande
in 2000. Cerro Grande hit pretty unexpectedly, and the shelter, back when it was in the much smaller facility on Cerrillos Road, was just nailed with a massive influx of animals. And I think in that moment, we realized that we were not prepared. At the time, I was not working at the shelter, but was covering it for a newspaper, and I was shocked to see a couple of things. Number one, the chaos that was happening, and number two, how well people were handling the chaos of these animals. And at that point, the campaign to build a new shelter, it was a 10-year campaign to raise the money to build a new shelter, really began to understand that if this new shelter was going to exist, it was going to have to exist as a center point for a disaster just like this. So when they were drawing up the plans, when those wiser minds than mine were putting everything together to make this happen, the realization that an evacuation center for animals would be needed, because in Santa Fe, it's not a matter of if we're going to get a fire at some point, it's just a matter of when.
And so what were the plans like? What did you actually do to make the shelter animal disaster friendly?
There's a couple of pieces of it. The first is to have 2 buildings. We as those who visited know, we have a receiving building and an adoption building. And what we are able to do, or one of the things I suppose that we learned in 2000, was that it's not the best idea to foster out owned animals from evacuees into private homes throughout the city, because you've got them scattered everywhere. You've got a whole bunch of animals with a whole bunch of different needs, and keeping track of them in the midst of chaos is very, very difficult. What we did was to take all of our adoption animals that were already at the shelter and put them into foster care, either with foster parents that the shelter has or with any of the bunch of veterinarians in this town just stepped up, who had kennels, and took many, many animals from us. And Animal Humane New Mexico in Albuquerque took a number, just a whole bunch of folks really stepped up. What that let us do then was move the stray animals over into the adoption building and keep all the evacuation animals together in one building, where all of our kennel staff, all of our medical staff, and all of our volunteers could bring their various talents to bear for this population that was safe, together, and protected. And that was really a key to keeping everything flowing very smoothly. The other thing we did was, since we moved into that building about 6 years ago exactly, we're coming up to our anniversary, July 2005, 5, we've been doing various practice drills to be ready for a disaster. When this happens, what will we do? And we're very grateful to Evelyn Ward of VOAD for really helping us make that happen. So we've kept what we call the shelter in a box stowed away for a long time. And the shelter in a box is a big giant box with everything you need to take in a whole bunch of animals out of nowhere all of a sudden.
And what comprises everything you need?
This is tags, little collars around them, so you can assign a number and an identity to the animal. It's intake forms, it's collars and leashes, it's every bit and piece to make sure that when you have an animal in, you know who it is, and when it comes time for it to go home, you know who it belongs to, and keeping them safe and protected and healthy in between.
So when the Las Conchas fire broke out a few weeks ago, and it was very sudden and very, very rapid compared to the Cerro Grande fire even.
It was. I remember going to bed and it was whatever it was, 6,000 acres, and waking up the next morning and it was 45,000 acres.
Right.
And having this conversation with our director about, is this real or is this a misprint? Did somebody get a typo wrong somewhere?
Right.
Because how is this possible, right? Well, it was possible.
Well, and it so happened that very night you're talking about, I was driving home from Albuquerque, and the whole time, the entire horizon was on fire. It was the scariest thing I've ever seen.
It looks like a city, right? All of a sudden, it's lighted up. It's like you've got a city the size of Los Angeles on the other side of the mountain.
It was driving up to Los Angeles, only it was red and yellow, and it was burning trees.
That L.A. was our L.A., and rather than lit, it was on fire.
So this fire broke out. It was huge. It was very fast. What happened at the animal shelter?
We immediately, before, this was prior to the evacuation, even prior to the voluntary evacuation, which was close on the heels of the growth of the fire, but we called a meeting together very early the next morning of our department heads and said, all right, we know what's going to come down the pike. Everybody get ready. And battle stations had already been divvied up, as it were, and so we were ready to go, and we started making those phone calls to get the animals out almost immediately, knowing that they were going to come in. And once the voluntary evacuation started, they began to trickle in and then come in a little heavier. And it was intense, but it was nothing compared to when the mandatory evacuation happened. And that's what we were all sort of waiting for. We knew that once the voluntary started and that this was 0% contained and 0% contained and 0% contained and then 45 and then 60 and then 80 and then 90,000 acres burned, this was going to happen. And when they started coming in, it was really amazing. We took our volunteers we had a number of experienced veteran volunteers, a couple of whom had actually been with the shelter back in the Cerro Grande fire, along with all of our staff. It was really all hands on deck the first night. We were there till midnight, and then we stayed open till 9 for, I don't know, a week or so after. It was astonishing to see this group of people come together to take in animals very smoothly, to move them very gently back to a kennel, because we're not talking stray animals who are already a little wonky in the head, maybe sort of unsocialized, they haven't had a lot of human contact. These were well-loved domestic animals, all of whom were a little bit pudgy and used to the couch, ready to go back home, but instead they were coming into a kennel. So
and having presumably all kinds of separation anxiety.
All kinds of separation anxiety. So having this very smooth intake process combined with volunteers who were spending tons and tons and tons of time with these animals was key. We had all of our experienced dog walkers called in, and they were taking these dogs out from, they would get there often before the bulk of the staff, and they would stay all day long to get them out, because there's that powerful empathic realization that if this was my animal and he was coming to the shelter, as lovely as our shelter is, it's very different than the comforts of home. It's very different than the comfortable couch, the cozy bed that you bought, the bone that you love to chew on every night. It's a very different environment.
And above all, the relationships that you have with your owners.
Precisely. Precisely. So between the volunteers getting them out regularly for walks, for exercise, for sunlight, just to de-stress them, we had a lot of owners also coming in to spend time with their animals. And that was a huge help. A lot of them couldn't through no fault of their own. They were either evacuated somewhere far away, or they still had their regular jobs in Santa Fe or elsewhere to go to. But a lot of contact between owners and pets just to help stabilize them. And you know, a side note, one of the funniest things that I saw were the matchings of animals that people have. What you don't get to see in normal shelter life is what the sort of animal demographics of a home really are.
Well, did you see that whole dogs who look like their owners thing going on?
There was definitely some of that. In fact, there were even some guinea pigs who looked like their owners. But it was great to see these sort of mismatch. We had this a duo that was this enormous gentle German Shepherd and a corgi that looked like a miniature version of the German Shepherd together. We had a trio of very old dogs, one of whom was this enormous blue pit bull, beautiful, totally sweet, who came in with two old chihuahuas, one, say, medium-sized and one really tiny. And the tiny one was the nastiest, most domineering, very sweet with the people, but so nasty and domineering to the other two dogs. At one point, I was visiting with them, and the pit bull was pushing her head into my chest, you know, just kind of nuzzling up and being very sweet. And the chihuahua crawled into my lap, and at one point, the pit bull poked her butt with her nose. And that little tiny 6-pound toothless chihuahua turned around and barked at her in a way that said, not only should you not have done that, you will never ever do that again, and I will shame you into the corner. And that pit bull, who must have been 10 times her size, if not more,
and could have swallowed her whole.
Backed off and said, yes, ma'am, I'm sorry, ma'am, no, it will never happen again, I'm very sorry, my fault. So by the end of the influx, I think we had 166 animals, guinea pigs, several cockatiels, which I learned the hard way will bite you if you try to touch them, and even one turtle who was named Zeus, who really was one of my favorites. When Zeus's mom came back to pick him up, she came in with which I thought was just brilliant, with a very big stock pot to take him home in. Like, you know, we have our kennels for our dogs and our cats. What a perfect way to transport a turtle. Nice, tall side so he can't climb out when you're driving, right. Put a little water in there to keep him moist. It was really very sweet.
How long did these animals stay at the shelter before they were returned to their owners?
The last two dogs went home on Monday. The 10th?
11th,
and,
yeah.
The 11th. And those were the last two. Some of them went home even during the mandatory evacuation. Folks had found their initial place to stay and then somehow parlayed that into pet-friendly housing and came back and got them. The bulk of them went home within 48 hours of when the evacuation was lifted and Los Alamosans could repopulate the city. But some folks were out of town. The only place they could find to go was southern part of the state or Colorado or what have you. So it took a while for some of them, but most of them went home very, very quickly. And that was really the second part of our preparation. Not just how are we going to deal with it when they all come in, but how are we going to handle it when they're all ready to go back out? And it was very, very smoothly. We put together a little questionnaire because we really wanted to know, honestly, how we did from these owners. And I was really pleased to see consistently across the board that the process of getting them in and getting them back out was smooth. And that, I say that in a way that I fear may lack the requisite humility, but it's really because this astonishing group of animal lovers, staff, board members, volunteers, really came together and worked in harmony with each other. It was very, in many ways, it was kind of a non-event. Not because it wasn't dramatic or scary or frightening, but because everybody just kept their cool. Everybody kept their cool and worked together. And it was a beautiful thing to see. It was like watching a well-oiled machine.
And that is the direct result of planning, thinking ahead, and being prepared.
And loving animals and the people who care for them enough to throw your heart all the way into it. I think it was a combination of brain and heart.
So we've got just about a minute or less left. What else would you like people to know about the animal shelter? Any good dogs there
home? We have a ton of good dogs right now. And for July, we're doing what we call our big dog event. And this is the clever double entendre of big dog event, which means all of our big dogs, not the little dogs, the big dogs for July are available for the low, low, low adoption fee of only $20. And I think this is a great opportunity for people to realize how awesome big dogs really are. I think we get a little nervous about them. That seems like, just that that 70 pounds of caring for something is not as easy as 20 pounds of caring for something. But man, big dogs are awesome. I've been a big dog guy for most of my life. When I got my pug, I realized that what I love about little dogs is that essentially they're big dogs in a much more portable package.
But and if they pull on the leash, they don't pull you over.
Exactly. But there's lots of really, really great big dogs at the shelter, and they go overlooked simply because of their size. So this event hopes to promote them and get them out into the world.
Bill Hutchison is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, as always, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.